Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
The Trico Electric Cooperative, which does business in the Tucson area, is expanding battery-powered energy storage system capacity with the goal of cutting emissions in half by 2032.
Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack sharing five projects currently under consideration for PACE.
The La Plata Electric Association that does business in Colorado with the Ute tribes is providing new opportunities for clean energy in that part of Colorado. The Kauai Island Utility Cooperative in Hawaii is expanding its solar production for use during peak hours so that they can reach their goal of 100% renewable by 2033. In Emerson, Nebraska, we're financing a solar facility for the Winnebago tribe. And the Midwest Electric Cooperative Corporation, that's also located in Nebraska, is looking at creating more solar power and a renewable system with appropriate storage.
This is Agriculture Today.
The biggest, most important, and timeliest ask was to get the Farm Bill completed.
Darren Kopic, President and CEO of the Ag Retailers Association.
It's been delayed and delayed, and even though the chairman says he wants to have a mark off of the House side out of committee by the end of March, the number of legislative days remaining in this Congress between now and when they'll release for the election is getting perilously small. Plus, the Congress also has to deal with issues like Ukraine, Israel, anything with China and Taiwan, and passing the rest of the appropriations bills that they finally got half the job done last week, but there's another half of the job and arguably the bigger half still to be done. And all those things need to be addressed before they're likely to take up the Farm Bill on the floor. We have a specific request within that bill, and that is that people that are certified crop advisors would be considered as qualified for NRCS third-party service provider programs. Right now, even if you got a CCA, you have to go through some additional hoops to be able to be a TSP. And we and many, many others are advocating that if you've got a CCA, that should be enough.
Speaking of advocating,
it's one of those things that in town is known as an appropriations rider, but it basically says on the spending bill, here, agency, here's your money, but you cannot spend any of it to do this. And in our case, what it did, when the Department of Transportation rolled out a pilot program that we had requested and advocated for a couple of years ago, that would allow people that have a CDL but are not yet 21 years old to operate across state line and try to set up a pilot program so we could test that theory out and see if it's safe or not. And if it's safe, then obviously we'd want to expand that so that it would apply to anybody who's younger than 21 CDL. But when the Department of Transportation rolled that program out, they put two things in it that complicated the issue. One was they required in-cab cameras for people that participated in that program. And the other one was that they required employers to sign up over at the Department of Labor in their apprenticeship program, which has absolutely nothing to do with the CDL program or DOT. What it did, though, was anybody who was an employer interested in the program kind of threw their hands up and said, that's too much paperwork and bother for me to deal with. I'm not going to do it. So we weren't aware of anybody that had participated. What this appropriations writer said is, here, DOT, here's the money to run your agency for the rest of the year. And none of this money can be used to require that in-cab camera or enrollment at DOL's apprenticeship program for the people in that pilot. So very surgical cutout and a very positive move as far as we're concerned to make that program usable.
What are some of the obstacles to getting new drivers?
One of the obstacles to getting more drivers on the road is a new entry-level driver training requirement, which anybody who's brand new to getting a CDL or hazmat, you're going to have to go through this ELDT program, and it can add $6,000 or $8,000 to the cost of getting a new driver certified. So it can be a significant barrier. We teamed up with another association here in town that already had developed a training program, and so ARA now has an entry-level driver training system out and available for members to use. Members can find it on our website or contact us if they need information, but it should save a considerable amount of money getting those entry-level drivers up to speed and hopefully can get them turned around more quickly so they're available sooner.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
So, projected prices for 2024.
Nick Paulson is a University of Illinois ag economist.
For corn, we ended the price discovery period averaging $4.66 across the month of February with a price volatility or volatility factor of 0.19. Those are two pretty important parameters that go into determining how much your insurance is going to cost. Give you a sense of kind of how that evolved throughout the month of February. We started out with that December corn contract trading at 479 on February 1st, or settling at 479 on February 1st. And we just kind of worked our way down in terms of where that contract settled throughout February. Saw a little bit of upward movement there in the last week of February. But the average settlement price across the month worked its way down to that 466 level that we have here for the 2024 insurance year. That is just over 20% lower than the projected price we had last year, and also the projected price basically that we had in 2022 as well, of 590 and 591. And so that's has a couple of implications for guarantees and premium costs that we'll talk about. The volatility factor, which also affects premiums, a tick higher than it was in 2023, but lower than what we saw in 2021 and 2022. Fairly similar to last year, just slightly higher. If we look at soybeans, it's going to be a similar story. So 1155 with a 0.15 volatility factor is what we're looking at for 2024. Again, if we look at how that kind of evolved throughout the month, very similar to corn, I guess without the the move up at the end of the month, kind of consistently worked our way down, started out at 1186. By the end of the month, we had the November 2024 soybean contract settling at 1133. So the average across the month ended up at that 1155. With that 0.15 volatility factor, that is, again, just a tick higher than what we saw in 2023, but lower than what we saw in 2021, 2022. And I think Bruce is going to talk a little bit more about kind of the historical perspective on those. But the key point I want to make here is that those lower prices, so 21% lower than last year on corn, I think 16% lower is what that 1155 is, lower than last year's 1376 for soybeans. What that means on the good news, I'll start with the good news. The good news is that we'll have lower premiums in 2024 compared with what you might have paid for the same policy in 2022 or 2023. The bad news that goes with that, though, is that because of that lower price, we're going to see lower guarantees possible at any given coverage level on the revenue products that are the most popular. And while you can still insure the same yield levels relative to your APH yield, the projected price doesn't affect the bushels you can insure. It does affect the value of those bushels if a yield loss occurs. So you're going to be compensated at that lower projected price relative to the last couple of years. Kind of the second piece of bad news here is that, again, relative to the last couple of years, we've been moving up on the production cost side. We talked more about that in the previous webinar. And so we've got higher costs, lower projected prices, that you can insure at for 2024. So again, just want to highlight the, you know, premiums are lower, but that's because you're insuring a smaller amount of revenue or bushels at a lower value than you were with that higher projected price in previous years.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
This week, we get into the topic of taking a look at how good our cows are reproductively, and specifically how well they fit our production environment.
Dr. Mark Johnson is Oklahoma State Livestock Extension Beef Cattle Breeding Specialist on why calving season is a good time to analyze your herd.
And it's the time of year where we're making selection decisions on bulls. We typically would think, well, we need to watch that calf crop grow out and see how it may alter our selection and mating system in the future. But in reality, calving season is an excellent time to take a look at some things that are a pretty accurate barometer of how well our cow herd matches up to our production environment and the amount of forage we can grow and the management that we're able to provide. and what we refer to as calving season analysis. If we've got a good herd health management program in place and we did not provide an excessive amount of energy input in the prior breeding season, and we've got that short 60 to 65 day calving season that we like to see, if we are seeing 70% of our cows calving in the first 21 days, about 20% calving in the next 21 days, and we're only at about 10% of the cows that are calving in that final heat cycle or corresponding calving cycle of that short calving season, it's a good indication that our cow herd, in terms of mature size and milking ability, is a good fit for our production environment. So we refer to that as calving systems analysis or calving season analysis, the 70-20-30 split over three breakdowns of 21 days through that season. Some other issues that can be an indicator that we maybe got cows that are too big or they give too much milk. If we're seeing cows that are calving in a timely fashion, but we're really seeing them crash in terms of body condition, and we're just not able to get enough nutrition into them to keep them in good shape in the early part of raising that calf, it can be a sign that something isn't matching up or isn't fitting. If we are routinely seeing replacement heifers that are coming out of our own operation and they are not getting ready to breed and calve on time as two-year-olds, or potentially over time we're seeing more of our cow herd fall into the later part of the calving season, we may have some things to address. And so a couple of easy selection tools that we can get into in terms of trying to moderate that mature cow size or potential milking ability. If we take a look at the milk EPDs, mature weight and mature height EPDs can be an effective means of selection if we need to address some of these things. Other things to keep in mind in this regard, we know that bigger cows are going to transmit more growth, higher milk cows are going to provide more nutrition and lead to heavier wean calves. But in reality, there becomes a practical limit to how much of each of those things we can have. And ultimately, the combination of mature cow size and milk is going to show itself in the form of reproductive failure. If we can match up the right size and the right maternal potential in our cow herd, most commercial cow-calf operations are going to increase the profit potential in the form of reproductive efficiency and a higher percent calf crop weaned.
Dr. Mark Johnson, Oklahoma State Extension Beef Cattle Breeding Specialist, on why calving season is a great time to analyze your herd. It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
On WTO, you're referencing the dispute settlement mechanism.
Doug McCallop is the chief ag negotiator with the U.S. Trade Representative.
I was over in Geneva in October. I did 11 bilaterals with countries, and we made progress on a lot of different pieces of agriculture trade. So there's a lot of facets to WTO. What you're referring to is after a dispute goes through an actual panel and there's an outcome of that, what happens in the appellate body. But we certainly are interested in getting past that, resolving that. That'll be certainly part of the discussions that happen in Abu Dhabi. My reason for bringing up WTO is to say that while the Minister of Agriculture committed to me on Monday that they would develop a proposal on what the reducing the duty or getting rid of that 18% tariff might look like, that seeing the ministers in Abu Dhabi as part of WTO will be another chance to remind them of that conversation. And so it's a forum where important conversations happen. We want WTO to succeed. There are certainly some countries that are coming forward with proposals to weaken the disciplines of WTO, to lessen the transparency requirements, to promote things like public stockholding, which quite frankly really undermine food security and undermine countries that are grappling with a lot of food insecurity issues coming out of the Russia-Ukraine conflict, et cetera. So we are looking forward to a good conversation coming up in Abu Dhabi, and certainly we'll be talking a lot about agriculture trade while we are there. But I have spent a lot of time with the Indonesians just even over the last month squarely discussing this and how to get to some fixes on issues that are irritating our trade back and forth. IPEV was mentioned earlier on, the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework. We made tremendous progress at language on IPEV, and quite frankly, Indonesia is one of the countries that we want to work bilaterally with to see if we can realize the gains of that language that we discussed as part of the IPEV initiative as we continue to try to get those pieces in place. So I've spent time with the chargé at the Indonesian embassy. There are a lot of work is happening with their capital, and we are moving toward working on some of those issues in a much more concerted and deep fashion. So getting some of the tariff issues out of the way, getting some of the regulatory barriers out of the way is going to be a major focus for us. As you mentioned, this is a really fast-growing market. A lot of consumers that can benefit, they're looking to lower carbon options. So it's a natural fit for us to prioritize that area. So that will be a big focus for us in 2024. Stay tuned as we continue to talk about how we describe this partnership, but that it will be a big focus for us. The other one, Ryan, just you got me thinking about it, is on a totally different continent, but similarly important, Africa. I was in Johannesburg in November for the launch of the AGOA reauthorization process. I hosted a breakout session that was focused just on food and agriculture. We had over 30 African nations that were part of that conference. There is very, very deep interest in making food a prime focus of AGOA, and they're very interested in energy coming from feedstock and how to make that part of those discussions as well. So we recently had some engagement with Nigeria that can bear some really important fruit. We've got excellent post. I always love visiting places, and this is an example where post is, you know, really on top of agricultural issues and engaged on things like energy. The Nigeria post is one that I think can be a real partner for us. So fostering that and getting to the next level for places like Indonesia, Nigeria can really end up being a shining star that we didn't maybe four or five years ago think about, but, you know, 3 or 4 years from now could be a real star for us on trade.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
What we're estimating, or what our calculator is estimating, as the likelihood or the probability or the chance that we would be triggering payments from that PLC program in blue and the Arc County program in orange.
Nick Paulson is a University of Illinois ag economist, recently on a webinar looking at crop risk management for 2024.
For three different Illinois county examples. So we have Champaign County is the first set of bars there. Champaign County is kind of right in the heart of East Central Illinois, also where the University of Illinois is located. DeKalb County is our Northern Illinois example. Both of those counties would be relatively higher productivity, just because the upper two-thirds of Illinois, we typically see higher yields and lower yield variability. And then we've got our Southern Illinois example, which would be our lower productivity, lower yielding and higher risk example there, Jefferson County, right in kind of the middle of Southern Illinois. So again, focusing on the top panel of this figure here for corn and wheat, we can see that for PLC, basically, roughly a 1 in 3 chance that we'll see the corn price fall below 440 or the wheat price fall below 550. That's, again, what it would take to trigger a PLC payment. And then, you know, higher likelihoods in that 35 to 45%, even as high as approaching that 50% range in some counties we've looked at in terms of triggering Arc County payment. So higher likelihood of Arc County payments for corn and wheat base.
And he reminds us that the crop insurance tools are online at farmdoc.illinois.edu.
The soybean side of things looks a little different. So this, you may have noticed that soybean expected soybean price for 2024 was kind of further above the price guarantee or the effective reference price for PLC and that benchmark price for the ARC program. So we see that sort of play out here in the, I would say, much lower likelihoods of payments in the top portion of what we're highlighting here. So basically, roughly a 10% chance of payments from either program here on soybean acres. So like a 1 in 10 chance. And then that translates to those lower expected payment levels. We're looking at the, you know, the two to, you know, at most probably $3 in expectation anyway, payment level for both programs. So much more of a toss-up if you're just comparing likelihoods and expected payment levels and making your decision on soybean base and looking at those PLC and ARC County programs. So to summarize, just reiterate here, based on what we're looking at for corn and wheat base, at least in Illinois, and probably extends to examples kind of throughout the Corn Belt region. Arc County is the program that looks to be more likely to trigger payments. And for that reason, the expected payment levels from that program are larger than for PLC. Soybeans, again, it's much more of a toss-up. In general, we're looking at a relatively low chance, 10% or less probably of triggering payments, and therefore much smaller expected payments or support levels for both PLC and Arc County on soybean base acres. Those aren't the only factors that you should consider when you're choosing between PLC and Arc. And probably the big one here as we segue into and start looking at crop insurance is, are you going to be interested in using that supplemental coverage option insurance program? And if you are, that kind of helps to make the Farm Bill program decision because you have to have those acres enrolled in PLC if you want to use that SCO program. If you're enrolling ARC individual or ARC county, those acres will not be eligible for that SCO coverage.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
In February specifically, only 18% say their household finances feel better than they were a year earlier.
Kansas State livestock economist Dr. Glenn Tonzer with a look at his latest meat demand monitor.
Why is that relevant for this meat demand discussion? Is geeks like me outside of this project would say that meat is an expensive item, and we tend to see meat demand grow with your income. And one step from that is if you're comfortable around your income and finances, meat demand is stronger. And we see that in spades month after month in the meat demand monitor. The part I highlighted in February specifically is those that say they're feeling worse off about their finances are spending quite a bit less away from home. So the change they're making is in think foot traffic and what they're willing to spend at a restaurant as opposed to foot traffic at a grocery store and what they're buying to take home. So they're making that pivot, and that aligns with what I just gave you a minute ago about the February versus January demand change. And they're making adjustments such as, you know, they might be trading down from steak to non-steak at the restaurant, or maybe they're having their steak when they go to the grocery store and they're cooking it themselves. Those kind of adjustments are cross-channel and cross-cut.
So that's a current look, but how does that compare to years past?
In February, I put out what I'd call special report. So we just got to talking about the standard four-page monthly report comes out all the time. And periodically myself or Justin Beener or other PhD students that help me with this project here at K-State, we'll do one-offs looking at, you know, called a deep dive in all things that the meat demand monitor lets us look at. And we did that on this macroeconomic issue about financial sentiment. So you can find this report. There's lots of figures and tables in it. I'm going to draw a bow around it. But the reason I'm doing it now is there's a lot of discussion of, and this gets into, it's an election year, so it's coming up about the state of the economy. You know, is the worst of inflation behind us? Will we have a second bout? Are my job, you know, or is my wages going to keep up with the higher cost of living? All those we've been talking about for a while, but they're getting elevated again. Now we're talking, you know, March of 24. So what I did was I went back and looked at all 4 years of data. So we have data from February 2020 through February 24 now, and we can look at this sentiment issue I was talking about. And quick reminder, by year, we were most optimistic as a nation in 2021. Looking at just the most recent 4 years. Not surprisingly, in 2020, when the pandemic hit, people were concerned. 2021, the pandemic got a little bit better. This is pre-inflation. We had federal government aid, you know, floating around, all those kind of things. So financial sentiment improved. Meat demand improved in 2021, and I detail that at nausea again in this report. But whether you were feeling better about your finances or not, all groupings had stronger meat demand in 2021 than 2020, which pulled up a lot of meat prices and with it livestock prices in 2021. That's the history lesson from there. Fast forward to the most recent 2 years, we've had slippage on household sentiment. So, and that's what I just broke down for February 24. The same thing on balance is held for the last 2 years. And the important part there is with it, we saw erosion of demand. So retail and food service demand that I just got talking about for February 24, we can look at it for the whole calendar year of 22, whole calendar year of 23. That's what we do in this report. And in 2022, we still had stronger demand by those that said their finances were improving, but not by the other groups. And by the time we got to 2023, all residents, regardless of their financial sentiment, were signaling weaker meat demand than in 2022. So think some staying power from this financial sentiment. Probably those that said their finances were doing better in 22 happen to have benefited more from the stock market rally in 2021, and or they had a job change that others didn't that made them kind of keep up the cost of living. So if inflation wasn't hitting them as hard, those kind of things are probably why they were in that position. And they were the main source of some staying power on meat demand in 2022. So 22 demand was sort of flat. but it was up for that group and down for the other, so it was flat for the country, is what I'm trying to impress on everybody. And by the time we got to 2023, that had all eroded, and it weighed on meat demand as we went through 23.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Picking up the pace regarding investments in clean energy projects. PACE, in acronym form, representing USDA's Powering Affordable Clean Energy Program. And according to Rural Development Rural Utilities Service Administrator Andy Burke,
Arizona, Colorado, Hawaii, and Nebraska, these are the different places that have been selected to go to the next awards phase.
Five projects total are being considered for a sum of $139 million in funding, with projects ranging from expanding battery energy storage system capacity to financing solar renewable energy resource facilities.
We're going to start working on the environmental reviews and getting these projects to where they can be completed. We want to make sure that we're not only completing these projects, getting the clean energy up and running, but also doing it in a way that is affordable for the communities.
I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.